It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, Minnesota Vikings star Adrian Peterson has come under fire this week for alleged child abuse. We'll take a look at the state of corporal punishment in America.
First, the rise of SWAT teams in the United States. Created in the 1960s to deal with unique and dangerous situations, SWAT teams have turned into a force increasingly used in more routine policing around the country.
And with the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, there are new questions being asked about the appropriate role of these teams. But just how did we get here?
Joining us now is Olivia Katrangian. She's a reporter at Retro Report, which looks to the past to help tell stories of the present. Olivia, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, take us back first to the 1960s when these SWAT teams were created. What purpose were they created for?
Well, in 1965, riots in the Watts section of Los Angeles left 34 people dead, and 42 square miles of this neighborhood were just destroyed. I interviewed a former member of the LAPD who said, "We had never seen anything like it. Watts was just burning to the ground." And so the LAPD was caught off guard. They were being shot at. They didn't know how to control the riots. And so they called in the National Guard. And it took over 14,000 National Guardsmen to quell the riots. And so they realized they needed a specialized team to deal with dangerous events like this violent unrest, but also hostage takings and sniper shootings. And so they decided to form a SWAT team.
And those SWAT teams, as you point out in the Retro Report, were first used for things like shootouts with members of the Black Panther Party or the Symbionese Liberation Army. Were these viewed as successful operations for the first SWAT teams?
They were. The shootout with the Black Panthers was sort of the LAPD SWAT team's debut. And after 4.5 hours, the police were seen as sort of the winners in that shootout. And Their reputation was really cemented, though, on a national level after the shootout with the Symbionese Liberation Army 5 years later in 1974. The SLA had kidnapped heiress Patty Hearst, and they had, you know, committed several crimes in Northern California. And finally, the LAPD SWAT team was able to apprehend them after this long shootout in downtown L.A. And so those were seen as successes, and soon after, the SWAT TV show came out, as did a SWAT video game and a board game. And so SWAT really became part of the pop culture.
And it became part of police culture. How quickly did SWAT teams start spreading once people saw this example?
Well, law enforcement agencies around the country started to form their own SWAT teams in the late 60s and early 70s. And today they've spread not just to major cities, but to smaller cities as well. In 1983, roughly 1 in 10 small cities had a SWAT team, and now 8 in 10 have SWAT teams.
And their mission has changed, first in the war on drugs.
Yes. When Reagan amped up the drug war, that rhetoric, that war rhetoric, really filtered down into police forces. And SWAT teams morphed into the soldiers in that war. And as criminologist Peter Kraska said in our piece, they started fighting the drug war inside people's homes. So today, SWAT teams are deployed about 160 times every day, and 80% of those deployments are to search for drugs. And that's a complete reversal of their role.
And with more SWAT teams out there conducting house raids, like you're talking about, there are chances of things going wrong. Can you tell the story of what happened to a Wisconsin family while they were out of the state in one of these raids?
Yes, their home in Janesville, Wisconsin, had burned down. And so they were staying with their family members in Georgia. And I interviewed the mother whose toddler was hit by a stun grenade when a SWAT team broke down their door at 3 o'clock in the morning. The toddler's face and chest were badly burned because the stun grenade landed in his crib. Their nephew had allegedly sold drugs to an undercover agent from the home earlier that day, but the police, he wasn't there, and the police were able to peacefully apprehend him at another location after a knocking and announcing themselves.
And you also quote an interview in this piece, a mayor who was raided mistakenly by a SWAT team.
Yes, I interviewed a mayor in Maryland whose two dogs were shot and killed in a botched SWAT raid. He was the victim of a drug scheme in which a drug dealer was sending packages to unsuspecting victims. The county SWAT team had intercepted one of those packages that was addressed to his wife, and they actually delivered it to him undercover. And when the mayor brought it inside, not knowing that the box contained 32 pounds of marijuana. The SWAT team broke down his door and immediately shot his two dogs, handcuffed him and his mother-in-law, and they were handcuffed, you know, for 2 hours before the SWAT team realized, you know, we've made a mistake.
I want to play a short clip, a couple blasts from the past in the news world in this retro report.
In a society such as ours, dedicated to individual rights, what are some of the dangers and ramifications of such elite police units?
Are the policemen acting too much like soldiers?
So, Dan Rather, 1986, Peter Jennings, 14 years later in 2000. Here we are talking about this 14 years later. Do concerns of public apprehension about these special weapons and tactics teams kind of come and go in waves over the years?
They do come and go in waves, but I think it really took the police response to the events in Ferguson, Missouri, recently to start a national dialogue that we're seeing today, and then to, create the need for a Senate hearing on police militarization. And so that happened last week. The Senate looked at the 1033 program, which allows the transfer of military equipment to local police departments. In Wisconsin alone, the Pentagon, through that program, has given Wisconsin police agencies more than $28 million in surplus military equipment just in the last decade. And so we're sort of reviewing this now and seeing, do we need that equipment? Is it necessary? And I do think SWAT teams are definitely a necessary part of law enforcement. We saw that at the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and after the bombing at the Boston Marathon. We need specialized teams for certain situations, but it took the police response to protests in Ferguson to make us look back and say, how did we get here? You know, is this a necessary part of our law enforcement in all the ways that it's being used today?
Yeah, the precipitating incident you talked about, the Watts riots in the mid-60s, were, you know, square miles with fires, people shooting at police and fire rescue personnel. So that you could kind of see why that might motivate the creation of SWAT teams. The Ferguson protests looked very different than that.
Yes. Since the Watts riots and the creation of the LAPD SWAT team, police do have a lot more equipment, and they now have body armor. And a lot of that is because police have been in situations where they're in danger, and they've needed body armor. And so a lot of that is necessary, but do we need to respond to protesters with, you know, body armor, tanks, guns? That's the question today.
Is there, you quote some experts on the subject who are questioning the militarization of police and maybe the mission creep of SWAT teams. Do you get the impression that police departments are starting to rethink where they draw the line between ordinary policing and this almost paramilitary approach?
Well, you know, because of these several cases of botched SWAT raids, several police departments have been sued, and they've gotten into very expensive lawsuits, and so they have sort of questioned the necessity of their SWAT teams. And I think after the riots in Ferguson, Missouri, people have been questioning their SWAT teams, and some actually have given equipment back.
Olivia, thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting story you've told.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Olivia Katranjian. She's a reporter at Retro Report. She joined us to talk about the origins and the rise of SWAT teams here in the United States.
You are listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you struggle with procrastination? An expert shows us how to stop putting things and our lives on hold.
First, news broke last week that Minnesota Vikings star Adrian Peterson was indicted by a Texas grand jury on charges of child abuse. The running back has admitted to hitting his 4-year-old son with a branch. And now a second investigation is looking into the possible abuse of another one of his children.
It's a story that's touched a nerve with many around the nation. While some find Peterson's actions reprehensible, others argue that parents should have the right to freely and physically discipline their children. The fact remains that corporal punishment remains relatively common in the country. In every state, a parent can legally hit their child as long as the force is reasonable. But from a child development standpoint, should they?
Joining us now to talk about the issue is George Holden. He's a professor of psychology at Southern Methodist University who studies parenting, discipline, and family violence. George, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to start with the specifics of the Adrian Peterson case. What do we know so far about what happened?
Well, what we know is that Adrian Peterson admitted that he was physically disciplining his child with a stick, or switch as he called it, and he admits that it got, he admits that he left marks on the child and injured the child in his, the child's scrotum. He was a 4-year-old child, and these are what he has revealed to both his wife and also, I guess, his lawyer.
And there are charges, it sounds like, pending or investigation, at least, of him abusing a second child.
That I'm not aware of those reports yet.
As we mentioned earlier, it's legal for a parent to hit their child as long as the fault is deemed reasonable. And, you know, I imagine that varies from state to state. But what would you say constitutes reasonable? It's a difficult word to unpack.
It's extremely difficult. And there's plenty of evidence and stories that parents and others who have actually clearly physically abused a child use the reasonable term as an excuse to get off and to avoid being put in jail. So it's a very troubling legal term that I'm not an advocate of. I don't think, in fact, in my view, there is no reasonable reason for a parent ever to hit a child.
And things have changed over the years in attitudes about corporal punishment, but there has been, it seems, a very gradual decline in the number of parents who practice it. Can you give us a sense how common corporal punishment is right now in the United States?
It's still extremely common. Anywhere, depending on the sample, depending on what part of the country, anywhere from 70 to 90% of the sample will say that either will say that they have hit their child, spanked their child, slapped their child, or will say that they approve of occasionally using corporal punishment as a disciplinary technique. So it's extremely entrenched in our society, and even though there's slight declines over the last 20, 30 years, those are small declines. It's maybe sort of five or maybe 10% in some samples of a decline over time.
And there are quite a few states that allow schools to use physical punishment as well. What are the statistics there?
Correct. There are 19 states currently allow corporal punishment to be used in public schools. Now, many of those states, there are few cases, but it's really the southern states where corporal punishment in schools is alive and well, and it totals up to about 200,000 cases per year of American children being paddled by school administrators or teachers.
So it's interesting. So we've just heard about 19 states where there is still paddling, corporal punishment allowed in schools. 70 to 90% of parents say that they have engaged in corporal punishment in the course of a year. How does that stack up for the rest of the world in terms of rates of corporal punishment?
Well, corporal punishment is, on the one hand, still quite common in many countries. And in fact, in some countries, the evidence is that children are hit and beat even more frequently than the U.S. However, at the same time, there are now 39 countries that have banned legally all forms of corporal punishment of children. Now, that doesn't mean these 39 countries that it's totally eradicated in those countries, but the fact is that the governments have passed legislation as a method, really, of trying to get social change to occur in their country. In some countries, it's been highly successful, like Sweden, where they passed it in 1979. Other countries, it's going to take a lot more time, such as, well, Brazil just passed it this past summer. And so it will take, you know, many years before that law actually has teeth in terms of parents stopping to use the technique that they've been using.
Why do you suppose that when we look at other countries, if you look, for example, at Sweden, they've had a big dive in attitudes about corporal punishment. There's less tolerance for it. It's not allowed legally. Why has it been so slow in America for attitudes to change? What is it about what's happening here that makes it more common?
Well, I think for one reason, the parents' rights seem to be forefront in Americans' minds, as opposed to children's rights. So we rarely talk or consider that children have rights, though the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which has been passed by every country except the U.S., Somalia, and South Sudan, indicate that children have a right not to be hit. But Americans do not seem to put much stock into the idea that children should have rights, at least compared to parental rights. Whereas in many other countries, they not only have passed the convention, but also try to actively think about what's best for children and recognize that there are competing rights, that parents do in fact have rights, but also children have rights. And certainly a basic right of everyone, every individual, is one of not being hit.
Is there a common answer that we hear when parents are asked why they engage in corporal punishment?
Well, certainly the most common one is, like Adrian Peterson reported, it was done to him. So he has just assumed that that is the right way to rear a child, because he would say, oh, I turned out fine, so I will do that to my children. But there's lots of different what I call determinants of parenting. So there's, besides that intergenerational one, other determinants are general culture, so what people around you are doing, your view of what's normal, the religious right, those who interpret the Bible, particularly Old Testament and Proverbs, literally, will argue that the Bible implores them to use corporal punishment on their children. And there's other determinants such as stress. Parents who are more stressed are more likely to spank because it's an emotional reaction when there's conflict. So there's lots of sort of determinants like that.
Now, obviously, this is a story. It's touched a lot of nerves with a lot of parents on both sides of this issue. What does the research suggest about whether corporal punishment works?
Well, the research is amazingly consistent. And it not only, it shows corporal punishment is essentially ineffective for what parents want it to do, which is change behavior in the long term. Corporal punishment does, of course, change the immediate behavior, because a child who is spanked or slapped isn't going to continue for the next 10 seconds exactly what he or she is doing. But it's corporal punishment is ineffective in changing behavior from a longer-term perspective. For example, this past year I published a study where we looked at mothers who gave consent to audio record their interactions with their children in the home. And in the course of listening to hundreds of hours of recordings, we came across 41 incidents of corporal punishment. And in 73% of those cases, within 10 minutes, the children were misbehaving again, often doing the same thing that they had been doing that led to the corporal punishment. And so it's clear that in the short term, corporal punishment is not working. Parents repeatedly will spank the child for the same misbehavior. And in the longer term, if you look at does corporal punishment lead to better, as we call, moral internalization, better behavior, better values kind of thing. There's no evidence that it does, and in fact is more likely to lead to the opposite, that children who are spanked are more likely to misbehave, to be aggressive, to have mental health problems like depression or anxiety.
We're talking right now with psychologist George Holden about corporal punishment in the United States, pegged to the recent news that Minnesota Vikings star Adrian Peterson is facing child abuse charges for allegedly beating his sons.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, your thoughts on the use of corporal punishment. Do you spank your children? If so, why? If not, what do you do to discipline children instead? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with psychologist George Holden about the debate over corporal punishment in the United States. It's been reignited after the high-profile indictment of the NFL football player Adrian Peterson, who's currently facing child abuse charges.
You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about spanking or other forms of physical discipline when it comes to misbehaving kids? Have you practiced corporal punishment in your own home? If so, why? If not, what do you do instead? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're going to go to our phones now and take a first call from Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for taking my call. Interesting juxtaposition. A couple weeks ago, we had a football player who beat his girlfriend, and there was universal outrage and condemnation, as there should have been. Now we have a football player who beat his son, and we're trying to decide if maybe that was okay.
All right, interesting point, Steve, and obviously a lot of a couple of rough weeks for the NFL, difficult things that we're talking about based on what's coming out of some of these players. But, George, do you agree with Steve? You know, Steve is suggesting here that this should be a done deal, that there should be widespread public condemnation instead of, you know, sort of weighing the benefits of corporal punishment. What do you think about that?
Basically, I totally agree with Steve that the behavior was totally unacceptable and ill-advised. On the other hand, I do want to express sympathy to the role that parents have to play and the fact that, in general, we in our society are not well-equipped to deal with that. So what happened was Adrian Peterson had to do what was done to him because he hadn't been educated better about what are better techniques for child rearing. So on the one hand, I agree it's totally inappropriate and abhorrent behavior, what he did, but also I want to express some compassion to Adrian, and recognize that parenting is a very difficult task.
Well, and anyone who's parented a child, has spent time around kids, know that they can try your last nerve. So what are some of those better techniques that you think parents should be trying instead?
Well, the basic rule is you never have to hit a child under any circumstance. Parents think they have to do that to get across the message, and that's absolutely not true. To get across a message, it's going to be much more effective if they do it in a gentle, loving manner rather than in the heat of the moment by inflicting pain. So with that in mind, you don't want to get, even though children know how to push parents' buttons, you don't want to get sucked into that and get angry. So that's often easier said than done. And we have three children, grown now, but our second child was a very challenging child. And I had to sort of put myself in a timeout in order not to spank him because I would get so infuriated by his behavior.
You put yourself on a timeout.
I had to put myself as well as him. But so we both cooled down and then dealt with the situation by communicating about it. So basically, a parent needs to sort of structure the situation so that you're going to minimize the likelihood of conflict, but what I call being a proactive parent, anticipating what the child might do and structure the situation to avoid problems.
All right. Well, thank you to Steve for his call. And I want to jump in so we can get to our next caller. Megan joins us next from Michigan. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So I was spanked as a child, and I'm finding myself spanking my own daughter, and it's just appalling to me. And I've tried to change my behavior, and it's not worked. And what I'm wondering is, can you suggest resources for parents where we can go to actually change that behavior? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for calling, Megan. And what do you think are their resources, George? Where can parents go if they want to try something else?
Well, there's lots of different resources, and I applaud Megan for recognizing that it's not a good practice and wanting to change. But, of course, as she points out, it's not easy because that's what sort of comes naturally to us if that's the way we were raised. So in almost any community, there are various parenting resources that you can go to. There's also lots of books and lots of free information on the internet about what is now called positive parenting or positive discipline. And a lot of this information takes time. It's not going to work overnight, but begin, and depending on the particular circumstances and how challenging the child is, it can be more or less difficult to enact. But try different resources, and by all means, get help, because it can only get worse, and you don't want to do things that will inadvertently damage even temporarily your child or your relationship with your child. So I encourage you to pursue positive parenting or positive discipline techniques.
All right. Well, thanks again, Megan. And we're going to go next to Tina joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Tina.
Hi. I don't know, because my grandmother, I got a whipping once, like Mr. Peterson's son. Didn't break skin, but then again, I sat on my cousin and made her eat a daddy long legs, and my grandmother was not terribly thrilled with this. And I don't know, maybe just our family is a bunch of wee feral animals, but we were bad kids. I mean, we did bad, destructive things. And we definitely caught it if we got caught. We got spanked. We got sent to our rooms. We sort of took it in good spirits. You did it. You got caught. You sort of earned it. And we managed to, like, not to grow up into normal human beings. And I have seen some of the children loose in the mall with their parents struggling but trying to modify their behavior and with our rude, heinous little animals. I mean, I wouldn't have turned around and told my parents to F off in public or in private. But it seems to be, and then the parent will say, now we've got to work on that.
Gotcha, Tina. I'm going to get George in on this. Tina's saying, it sounds like it was something that she felt was necessary for her family, for the kids to grow up properly, to learn respect. What do you think about that argument? That's essentially the argument that Adrian Peterson has made, that that's what his childhood was like as well, and that discipline helped him grow up. What about that?
Well, I don't buy it. I don't buy that spanking means discipline, and if you don't spank, it means you're raising a child without discipline. Firm guidance and firm discipline is a hallmark of good parenting in anyone's book, including positive parenting. But they just say, positive parent advocates argue that you never need to hit, and perhaps some of the misbehavior is due to reactions to being hit. And what you really want to do is develop positive, open communication and good relationships with your parent, and respectful ones, so that your child will respect you, but also you respect your child and your child's individuality. Now, of course, kids are kids, and they do not yet have the self-control that an adult does because of their lack of brain development in the frontal cortex. So parents need to recognize that kids are going to engage in some behaviors that are inappropriate. But again, you have to sort of structure situations, and you have to have correct expectations about child behavior, and just engage in respectful parenting that isn't going to do damage, which spanking can do for some kids. It's not going to do it for all kids, of course, but
George,
we're talking about... Yeah.
In our final moments, I want to ask you, ABC News has reported that the Midwest hits their kids the most often after the South. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not sure about the Midwest. I have seen those statistics. And perhaps you can, as someone who lives in the Midwest, can help explain that better. In the South, it's clear for various reasons that there's more of a tradition of corporal punishment. It's a Bible Belt. And there's also tends to be more of a culture of honor in the South where parents will expect immediate obedience and immediate respect from a child. But in the Midwest, it's less clear to me. So perhaps you or someone in the audience can help answer that.
Well, George, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
George Holden is a professor of psychology at Southern Methodist University. He studies parenting, discipline, and family violence. We've been talking about the debate over corporal punishment, which has been reignited after the high-profile indictment of Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson, who is facing child abuse charges after beating his children. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, since a federal appeals court on Friday reinstated Wisconsin's voter ID law, voters may be confused about how the law is going to affect them, what forms of ID they need. We'll check in with the director of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board.
But first, do you suffer from put-it-off-till-later syndrome, also known as procrastination?
Here are some of the symptoms. You feel like your life is constantly on hold while you're organizing the drawers, clearing the desk clutter, answering all of your emails.
Well, in this week's Teach Me What You Know, we're asking a comedian and super organizer for help.
Without putting it off any longer, Samantha Bennett is with us. She's the founder of the Organized Artist Company and author of the book Get It Done, From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. Hi, Veronica.
So what is it? What lies at the root of procrastination? Why do we put stuff off?
Put stuff off mostly because of fear of success, fear of failure, fear of looking foolish, fear of investing a lot of time in something and then not having it work out. But the fact of the matter is we all have projects that are really close to our heart, you know, that really matter to us. And somehow every single day we get everything done for everybody else. And that, you know, that writing project, that photography project, that clutter clearing project, even though we know it would make a huge difference in our life, it keeps going undone.
And so what are some baby steps that we can take once we acknowledge that we have a procrastination problem, but we don't want it to run our lives?
Well, the first thing I would do is just really get in touch with the desire. The fact that you've been procrastinating is actually great news. It's a sign of your genius. You know, you have this idea that will not leave you alone. And you feel bad about not doing it. This is great news. So to really just get in touch with how strongly you want this thing, whatever it is. And I invite everybody listening to go ahead and make this commitment right now. Spend 15 minutes a day, every single day, before you check your email. Before you check your email, spend 15 minutes a day on the projects that matter most to you.
Now, 15 minutes doesn't sound like much. Can 15 minutes of focus on something really help do that task, whether it's a big creative project or a household chore?
You know, it's jaw-dropping how much work you can actually get done in 15 minutes, even if it's just doodling or daydreaming or staring at a blank piece of paper for 15 minutes. you know, a little bit of enforced boredom is not a bad thing for a person. I had one client who kept insisting that there was no way she could get anything done in 15 minutes. She was a jewelry designer. She's like, it takes me 15 minutes just to get my stuff out, you know. But then she made, right? And she made herself a little tray. So she had her things sort of already out, and she could, you know, bring it out onto her desk, set the timer for 15 minutes, do a little work. Well, at the end of a week, she had completed 3 necklaces, which was 3 more than she had completed in the previous 6 months.
But what about when the project you're thinking about that won't leave you alone is huge? What if you want to write the next War and Peace, or you want to make a movie? What do you do to sort of get any sort of progress done on something that seems so daunting at first?
Yeah, it's one of the great things about working with creative people is they get these huge, beautiful ideas, and they're so rich and complete, and there's, yeah, they're long, and there's sequels and theme parks and T-shirts, you know, all kinds of things. And it's immediately overwhelming. You're immediately paralyzed, because how could you even move forward on such a giant, giant task? So I think the key is...
Sam, have we lost you there?
You there?
Yep, you cut out for a second. So you were telling us the key to taking that big daunting project and rolling with it.
Yeah, chunk it out. Tiniest possible movements. Little itty-bitty movements. I have one client who decluttered her entire house in 5-minute increments.
Wow.
She had two twin toddler boys. She had even 15 minutes was like, she was like, I don't have 15 minutes. But she had 5. And she would set her timer for 5 minutes, and she and the boys, she would do, you know, 10 inches of a bookshelf. She would do this part of one drawer. She said at the end of 10 months, her entire house looked like Dwell magazine.
Wow.
She said her mother came and could not believe it.
Wow.
Is there some element of self-deception here? Like, if we get ourselves on the hook to do that 15 minutes, some of the time we're going to get on a roll and just, oh, the time ran off, but I'm going to keep going here.
Absolutely. Sometimes you sit down for 15 minutes and get up 6 hours later, and that's great. We love it when we get in the flow like that. And like I said, in other times, you know, the 15 minutes is going to drag by. But the beautiful thing is when you know you are doing it every single day, it takes off that pressure of perfectionism. You know, if you don't do so good today, it's fine. You'll do better tomorrow.
So listening to you talk about that mother who decluttered her entire house in 5 minutes a day made me feel bad. I thought, oh, she's a better person than I am. She was able to declutter her whole house. Is that the fear you're talking about? I mean, is that the voice that stops you from beginning anything to start?
Certainly that comparison monster is going to get you one way or the other. I think thinking either they're a better person than we are, or the one I hear all the time that kind of makes me crazy is, well, it must have been easier for them. You know, like they must not have been so shy about putting their work out there, or they must, you know, somehow have more time or more money, or look, she's so beautiful, or, you know, she's friends with so-and-so, or look at her family. And I'm here to tell you, it is not easier for anyone. It's just as hard for everybody else as it is for you. And you've got to start right where you are.
Now, Sam, one tactic I try sometimes, it goes in fits and starts, is the magic to-do list. I'll jot down things big and small I need to get done. It seems to work for a while. Are you a fan of the to-do list?
I find that to-do is a little too much pressure for me. Like, I feel like I'm being chased by dogs. Like, it's too much. What I do is I label it could do. I could do this.
Oh, no, we lost another critical part of the sentence. What were you going to say, Sam, about why you like could do better? We lost her for good.
Her this time.
Well, at least she got to answer that other giant cliffhanger, the 15-minute thing. We're going to try to get her back.
In the meantime, though, you can share your to-do list ideas, your anti-procrastination tips over at the Central Time Facebook page. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do we have time to get callers in here? What the heck? 800-642-1234. I got to say, this rings kind of true to me. You know, clean the basement. never going to happen, right? It's a daunting, huge thing. Spend 15 minutes vacuuming the cat-sized hairball, or, you know, those dust particles in the basement. That I can do. I can do that 15 minutes and make it work, and that actually does something. Have you managed to break things down like that, Veronica?
You know, I think I'm more of a marathoner. It's funny you used the suggestion about cleaning your basement. Mm-hmm. I did clean my basement, but I pushed through. I muscled through. It was a marathon until, you know, the wee hours of the morning, which tends to be how I get things done. But sometimes, you know, that doesn't work because some jobs are just too big to finish in a single sitting. So it's interesting. The bite-sized chunk thing is a good suggestion.
Huh. But we're different people, you and me.
We are?
Yeah.
Good to know.
Well, Sam, you're back with us, Sam Bennett. Can you share some more success stories with this 15-minute idea? What have some of your clients, apart from that big house cleaning, gotten done with that 15 minutes before email of getting this thing done?
It's amazing. I have one client right now who's putting out a little video every single day. She calls it A Moment with Marianne, and it's a little one-minute video that she puts out. I've got clients who've finished novels. I've got clients who finished book proposals. I've got clients who've made movies and finished screenplays and changed jobs, started a new business. I mean, there's almost nothing that can't be done, at least in the beginning, in 15-minute bits. And this joy that you feel when you're actually in it is, I think, the thing that gets missed. You know, it's when you're not doing it, it feels big and hard and arduous. But when you're actually doing it, even if you've only done a little bit, it's like that feeling you have when you fall in love. I mean, the parking lot of the Trader Joe's is still a mess, but you don't care because you're happy.
Well, I want to get in a caller quick before we run out of time. Kurt in Wisconsin Rapids is with us. Hi, Kurt.
Yes. Say, I was reading a book once about ADD, and they said there's two times for people with ADD, now and not now. Mm. And that pretty much typified my life, and the idea was do it now. And that has helped me immensely. I tend to get into a project, and then when I'm done, I walk away and leave all the mess still there.
But you're doing it now. Great. Kurt, thank you so much. And in our last moments here, Sam, is there something to that, to seizing the moment for everybody?
Absolutely. If you're having a thought over and over again, that's your engraved invitation from heaven, you know? Don't put that off, particularly your creative projects. The world needs your art. Don't leave us hanging.
All right, Sam, thank you so much for joining us today and for the inspiration.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Samantha Bennett, founder of the Organized Artist Company and author of Get It Done, From Procrastination to Creative Genius in 15 Minutes a Day. And hey, if you've got a big creative project that maybe she inspired you to take that 15-minute stab at, let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.